Shutdown, no. Massive legal fight, yes. Plus, Brexit, it's coming. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdal. It's Friday, the 15th of February. Thanks for joining us. Shutdown avoided, national emergency declared, lawsuits filed. It was a busy week here in Washington as lawmakers scrambled to make a deal to avoid another partial government shutdown. As you've been hearing, Congress passed a deal to do that without giving the president the money he wants for a border wall, which the president plans to get around by moving funds from elsewhere in the government using that national emergency declaration. Hence, those lawsuits I mentioned. For that and more, we'll start with our weekly wrap of the business and economic news that was. We have Edward Jones analyst Nela Richardson and The Washington Post's Catherine Rampell, both live in our New York studio. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
And let's talk about what this deal means for the broader economy, because the shutdown and the threat of a shutdown had businesses in particular pretty rattled.
Certainly it was not good for consumers, not good for businesses to have this lingering, festering, self-inflicted wound in the form of lots and lots of Americans, both on government payrolls and contracted out by government contractors, not getting their paychecks. So none of that was good for businesses. None of it was good for the ecosystem of businesses that rely on spending by those workers. And of course, if you care about just sort of the symbolism of all of this, that government can't get its act together and even get a budget happening, that also matters a lot. I do think that if you're a business person, particularly if you have any sort of global exposure, you still have lots of other sources of uncertainty still hanging over your head, including, of course, Brexit, as well as what's happening with the China trade war, which is another self-inflicted wound at this point. So it's not like everything's hunky-dory at this point, but certainly I'm sure this will be a relief to a lot of people who are worried that we might have yet another shutdown.
And Nela, U.S. small business confidence hit a two-year low this week, and there's been lots of talk about the possibility of a recession. But if you look at consumer confidence, folks seem to think that everything's just great. So what's behind that disconnect?
Well, you know, that small business sentiment has been at record highs. And part of the reason is because of the tax cut and because of the fiscal stimulus. As we see those tax cuts and that effect wane on the economy, we head to a bit slower growth. You're going to see that optimism also wane a bit, but it's still high when you're looking at historical levels. So business sentiment is probably in pretty much lockstep with a modestly growing economy. We saw that in the consumer sentiment as well. It took a dive with the shutdown that was unexpected, but we've seen that rebound in coming months. The problem for people who are looking at the economy is that the government shutdown also led us to have some blind spots in the data because there were a lot of data releases that were not released during that three-week period. So we're still catching up on what this all means for the economy and the outlook going forward.
And, you know, you're talking about some numbers that we missed. There were those retail sales numbers that came out. And we also had news today. Payless is planning to file for bankruptcy, yet another victim of the retail apocalypse. But filing for bankruptcy again, closing close to 2,300 stores. Any broader issues at play here?
I'll take this one, and then I'd love to hear Catherine's thoughts. But yeah, the broader issue is that we don't shop like we used to. We go online first, and that's caused stores across the landscape to make investments in technology, online delivery, and shipping that cuts into profits. And the simple fact is we don't need as many brick-and-mortar stores as we used to have. And so that's driving some retailers out of business like Payless. I don't think this will be the end of that trend, but it's also causing major retailers to make investments that are cutting into margins as well.
There are some retailers that have tried to pursue some sort of alternative brick and mortar strategy, you know, like a more experiential, luxurious form of shopping. But it's not clear that that is a strategy that's going to translate so well for a budget type price point like a Payless, or even a mid tier price point like a Toys R Us or Sears or other big retailers that have suffered. You know, if you're talking about a high end product, a high end price point, then maybe you can try to salvage some of your walk ins or even boost them. But it's going to be very challenging for more budget for firms that rely much more on budget conscious customers.
And Catherine and Neela, before we go in just the last few seconds, I mean, the budget deal was the big news of the day. Other than, say, the border security and rural broadband, because we've got something coming up on that, what are your big takeaways from this deal, spending deal that Congress and the White House worked out?
It's going to be really hard to get an infrastructure bill through Congress. And there are a couple other things that are on the table, like the new NAFTA that still needs to be ratified. We're facing a debt ceiling in coming months, and we still need to figure that out. And that's going to need bipartisan support. So there are some concerns, even though the government reopening is good news. There's still some challenges ahead.
I think the biggest challenge is that look how long it took us to get a budget deal just for the current fiscal year, which ends at the end of September. We're going to be back where we were in just a few months, and we might go through the exact same rigmarole. I hope we don't have another shutdown. I hope we don't have another showdown, whether it's over additional border wall funding, because that may not make it through the courts. Probably it won't. We don't know. Or some other battle. We don't know. But it took us this long to get a budget passed for this fiscal year. I'm not looking forward to the abbreviated schedule we have for the next one.
Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post and Neela Richardson at Edward Jones, thanks so much.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Kimberly.
And markets didn't seem to mind all the Washington drama today. We'll have that and more when we do the numbers. Around the same time Amazon said it wouldn't pursue a new headquarters in New York City, GE announced it's dramatically downsizing its planned move to Boston. The company will now rent office space there instead of building a 12-story office tower, and it will repay some of the $87 million in incentives it received to make the move. Maybe it's just a coincidence, but these two major deals falling apart has us wondering. As cities and states find themselves courting these big investments, what happens when those deals don't work out as planned? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
In the battle to lure companies and the jobs they bring, states have to be careful, says Terry Rapan at the University of Virginia.
You want to cover yourself by only paying out when they meet certain performance thresholds, jobs, capital investment, wages.
Any upfront payment or incentive should be subject to clawbacks, money that has to be repaid if the company doesn't deliver on what it promises. States are increasingly savvy about protecting themselves, says Josh Goodman with the Economic Development Tax Incentives Project at the Pew Charitable Trust. But they need to be better at understanding the impact of the incentives they create.
Our research shows that 20 states don't have any consistent process in place for evaluating the effectiveness of tax incentives. Those states might have studied one incentive program at one particular time, but there's no consistent process for measuring the effectiveness of these programs.
And even with performance targets and clawbacks, there are costs states may not be able to recoup if a deal goes bad. Greg Leroy is the executive director at Good Jobs First, a nonprofit watchdog group on economic development.
If you spend a lot of money on infrastructure and suddenly it's not getting utilized, that could be a lost investment, staff time.
And then there's the opportunity cost, the other ways states could have spent that funding.
What if you had spent the same amount of money in your community college customized training program and your graduate engineering software programs and your public transportation structures?
In other words, investments that would have benefited many employers instead of a select few. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Amazon related, sort of. Monday on Marketplace Morning Report, we'll have a piece about how Walmart's getting into grocery delivery to compete with Amazon in that space. And bringing it back to Washington, that $1.3 billion for border security in the spending bill signed by Trump today is just one part of the larger spending package. Several agencies and programs will get more money for the rest of the fiscal year, including additional funds to build out internet connections in rural areas of the country. Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports on what $500 million of broadband would mean for those areas.
Take Maine, where the U.S. Census Bureau estimates about 20% of households don't have access to adequate broadband.
They're not connected at all, or they're not connected with a high enough speed, high quality, reliable service.
Peggy Schaefer co-chairs the Maine Broadband Coalition. She says it limits medical devices in rural hospitals. In one school district, the superintendent still uses a phone tree to notify teachers and students on snow days.
Our school districts are kind of big, so that's a lot of teachers and people that he needs to call.
It's also a huge hurdle for rural economies.
I have another business that doesn't have any broadband at all.
Mia Purcell promotes economic development in Oxford County, Maine.
This is a person who can't even process credit cards. I mean, that's pretty unheard of these days.
Rural areas present their own business problem for internet providers. They have to lay a lot of broadband cable for relatively few paying customers.
For most providers, it just doesn't make economic sense.
Jim Stegman at CostQuest consults with telecommunications companies. He says the $550 million in the budget deal for rural broadband can help. Some.
It's not anywhere close to what really the funding gap is for rural America.
Maine estimates it'll take $600 million just to connect its rural areas with adequate internet.
This additional money will help kind of tip the balance to hopefully get a number of the rural carriers to actually start deploying a higher speed service.
But the funding comes with a caveat. Rural areas that already have some slower internet won't be able to upgrade and connect to this new higher speed service. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
This next story is about the Environmental Protection Agency and regulation, not deregulation, which has been a big push under the Trump administration's EPA, but actual new regulations. There's a group of chemicals known as PFAS. You'll find them in microwave popcorn bags, dental floss, nonstick pans, waterproof shoes. The chemicals are basically unavoidable, but have been linked to birth defects, immune system problems, and possibly cancer. The EPA made a plan to regulate them, and then something unexpected happened. The chemical industry cheered the move, and environmental groups slammed it. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong explains.
These chemicals are turning up in water all over, from Minnesota to Alabama, from New Mexico to North Carolina. And as the feds respond to a nervous public, chemical companies have to do something too, says chemical industry lawyer Lynn Bergeson.
They recognize there is an issue. And it's important optically for all pertinent stakeholders to engage and fix a problem.
But skeptics see no fixing by the EPA. Environmental groups reacted with words like fail, fumble, foot dragging. The plan to limit chemicals in drinking water is just a restatement of intentions from the previous agency head, says Betsy Sutherland, a retired EPA scientist.
It is really repromising what Scott Pruitt promised back in May of 2018. So the industry has received a very significant delay.
Critics say the EPA is also moving too slowly to make polluters pay for cleanup. Stephen Aquario of the New York State Association of Counties says right now, small water utilities are on the hook.
There's a lot of financial impact to the communities here, so very important that the United States appropriate significant funds, but also manufacturing responsibility is part of this long-term cleanup effort.
The who pays question will matter in government and in court. New lawsuits are filed almost every day against chemical makers like DuPont and 3M. For its part, the EPA calls its plan a comprehensive nationwide effort to protect public health. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
this sort of like top-down approach to fashion where like this one creative genius is telling us all what to wear. Those are really outdated.
About Fashion Week. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 443 points, nearly 1.75%, to close at 25,883. The Nasdaq picked up 45 points, 0.6%, to finish at 7,472, and the S&P 500 climbed 29 points, 1%, to end at 2775. For the week, the Dow gained 0.3%, the Nasdaq climbed 2.5%, the S&P 500 rose 2.5%. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that Visa and MasterCard plan to raise transaction fees on credit cards. Visa rose 1.2%, and MasterCard gained 1%. And as we mentioned earlier, we have more corporate headquarters news a day after Amazon bailed on New York. GE is downsizing its plans for a move to Boston. GE found nearly 0.5%. Amazon lost 0.9%. In Europe, Britain's FTSE picked up 0.5%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody, it's Kai Ryssdal. Listen, you got to check out the latest episode of Make Me Smart. The Oscars are coming up with an armful of controversies. There is no host. There's blowback for who's nominated and who's not. And some of the Oscars for the craft of filmmaking, the actual making of filmmaking, got bumped to the commercial breaks. The Academy Awards have been trying to get more inclusive. How's that going?
It's a mess. That's why the ratings are down every year.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is that people just don't really want to. Nobody wants to watch people do HR on national television, live national television.
Right.
Who wants to watch that?
Right. Make Me Smart. Check it out.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Last night, Prime Minister Theresa May lost yet another vote in the UK Parliament over her Brexit deal. The prospect of the UK leaving without an exit deal is getting more real by the day. And that's fueled a surge in stockpiling. In fact, the highest level of stockpiling in a G7 country in more than a decade. People and companies are hoarding essential supplies, motivated by fear that if the March 29th deadline comes without a deal, trade flows into Britain will suddenly be slowed or stopped by border checks, potentially causing massive delays and shortages. From the London suburb of Worcester Park, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
In her smart townhouse on the outskirts of London, one of the richest cities in the world, Jo Elgarth is preparing for food shortages. Her larder is overflowing with emergency supplies.
For example, here we've got some corned beef, I've got dried potato, I've got rice, lots of rice packets, pre-cooked rice, sweet corn.
Must be plenty of baked beans as well.
Yes, we're British, we have to have our baked beans.
She says she has enough food in here to feed her family of five for up to 8 weeks. Is this really necessary?
Who knows? We have absolutely no idea. We have had no guidance from the government. I've got to think about my three children.
She's not the only one who's worried. In the month since she joined a small Facebook group to share tips on stockpiling, it's attracted almost 10,000 members.
Isn't it a little bit paranoid, though? OK, you haven't built a nuclear bunker in the back garden, but
no.
A bit paranoid.
But because we have absolutely no idea what's going to happen, I have to plan for the worst.
And she's not impressed with government calls to not stockpile.
The retailers are all saying they're stockpiling. Manufacturers are stockpiling.
For example, this small British manufacturer, which makes foldaway bikes, has stockpiled more than $1.25 million worth of parts to ensure the bikes keep rolling off the production line. Brexit anxiety is proving a boon for some companies. Take Emergency Food Storage UK. The company sells food and hydration kits for aid agencies working in disaster zones. The boss, James Blake, hit on the idea of a Brexit survival box.
We put together the Brexit box because we had the products to be able to do that. So we put together food for individuals to have a little bit of security during the Brexit process.
At around $380, the survival box isn't cheap, but Blake insists if food supplies dwindle after a no-deal Brexit, the box will keep you going for at least a month.
In the Brexit box, we've got 60 main meals. It's freeze-dried food, so you just add water and it goes back to its original state. It's nutritious. Really, it's designed for emergencies, so it has all the calories you need. It tastes pretty good too.
Not as good as fresh food, though, and that is particularly at risk. Britain imports roughly half of all the fresh produce it consumes, much of it from continental Europe. Some Brits, anxious about fresh food supplies, have flocked to this warehouse in North London. Paolo Arrigo runs this company, distributing seeds for a mouth-watering array of vegetables.
We've got the Costoluto tomatoes from Florence. We've got the Principe Borghese tomatoes down here from Puglia.
Arrigo says his sales of vegetable seeds have more than doubled since fears of a no-deal Brexit grew a month ago.
This is where we are. You know, this is what people are doing. Some people feel that they need to be growing their own vegetables in order to ensure that they have fresh vegetables which can't be stockpiled.
Since he imports the seeds from Franchi, an Italian company, Arrigo is also worried about Brexit delays. He's also tried to stockpile his product, but he can't. As soon as a huge new batch of seeds arrives, they fly off the shelves.
Seeds have always, through time, sold better in a crisis than they have in a boom. People have to eat.
Good for his bottom line, but he says this level of anxiety, this level of stockpiling, cannot be good for the British economy. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Another New York Fashion Week has wrapped up. The traveling caravan of designers, supermodels, celebrities, and influencers is now on to London for the next round. And once again, the question bubbles up. Is it really worth it? The expensive runway shows and parties, two times a year? Some designers are pulling out, and these days events seem less about the clothes and more about who's wearing them. Rebecca Jennings wrote about this for Vox. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So explain how the business side of Fashion Week works for us.
So the whole concept of Fashion Week is sort of an outdated concept, right? It's sort of evolved from these weeks out of the year where editors from magazines would, you know, go all over the city to see the latest collections that designers presented. And in the 90s, it was sort of organized into New York Fashion Week, and that's sort of what we know today. It was like, okay, we're going to make this all happen in one place. It's going to be this huge event. And it was really successful at doing its job and creating excitement about the fashion industry. But over the past decade or so, it's sort of losing the relevance that I think it once had.
But why do people say that Fashion Week is dying, or some people even say Fashion Week is dead?
So I think that's because Fashion Week just has lost a bit of its relevance in terms of how we buy clothing. The way we buy clothing now has a lot more to do with, like, okay, a collection comes out, we see it on Instagram, we see it, whatever, we want to buy it. And by the time, if you're waiting 6 months by the time you see a piece and the time you can buy it, that aesthetic is probably already played out. That trend is probably over.
If Fashion Week is less relevant to today's shoppers, where are people going for fashion?
I think fashion is happening a lot less from these traditional institutions. We look less to, you know, huge luxury designers, and we look less to magazines than we used to, because those industries are being democratized by social media. And so I think fashion is happening much more on the street level. It's happening in the culture that we choose to consume. And often that's music in TV shows and movies, stuff like that.
Despite all those things that you just said, luxury fashion sales, the kind that you see highlighted during Fashion Week, those are really strong right now.
Yeah, but I don't think that Fashion Week really plays into whether or not people are buying those things. And I think regardless of whether we get a runway show, we'll still see those strong sales.
Now, I can't mention luxury fashion here without talking about some of these designers like Gucci and Prada, who have come under fire recently for the use of racist, blackface-like imagery, cultural appropriation. I mean, this seems like yet another piece of evidence that this industry might be out of touch.
Absolutely. That's just one example of the ways in which, like, these old power structures where, you know, we have this sort of, like, top-down approach to fashion where, like, this one creative genius is telling us all what to wear. Those are really outdated. And that's where you get these horrible racist items that, like, clearly got zero input from a person of color or someone who has any, like, awareness of how these things work.
So, you know, you ask in your piece, is Fashion Week worth saving? What do you think?
I think it is. And I think it would be cool for Fashion Week to be relevant again. I obviously care about fashion and I like the idea of it sort of having an industry event the way that, you know, tech has CES and, you know, music has all whatever, a million things. I think there is a cool way that there could be a Fashion Week that doesn't look really much like it does now. I think it would have to involve a lot less fashion marketing and involve a lot more like, hey, what's the state of fashion right now? Like making it more of a conference or an expo, you know, something like that.
Rebecca Jennings covers pop and internet culture for Vox. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And this final note on the way out, a bit of closure in a long-running sports dispute. Professional football players Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reid have settled their collusion cases against the NFL. The two athletes alleged they had been blacklisted by the league for kneeling in protest during the national anthem. We may never know the payout, if there is one. Details of the settlement are confidential, and lawyers for the players and the NFL say they will have no further comment. But between lost wages and legal fees, some estimate a settlement could have reached into the tens of millions of dollars. Okay, we gotta go. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I'm Kimberly Adams. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.